Coming up, Catholic Charities in Illinois refuses to accept same-sex and unmarried couples for adoption or foster parenting. The state recognizes civil unions, and it wants to withdraw funding of the charity for such placements. And clinics in India pay impoverished women what for them is a lot of money to be surrogate mothers. But it's a bargain for the clients, who are often foreigners. Plus, the campaign to provide kosher restaurants with a seal of approval, provided they treat their employees fairly.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. A federal judge this week upheld most of Alabama's controversial new immigration law. The judge ruled police officers can be required to check the immigration status of anyone they suspect is in the country illegally. Public schools must also check the status of students. The part of the law opposed most vigorously by many religious groups was struck down. Christian clergy challenged a section that outlawed transporting or harboring illegal immigrants. They said it would prevent them from ministering to certain people. The judge's decision is expected to be appealed by both sides. Anwar al-Awlaki, an American-born radical preacher, was killed in Yemen by a U.S. airstrike this week. Officials considered him a major terror threat to the United States. His anti-American sermons inspired several plots against the U.S. But some ethicists and religious voices have raised questions about whether the killing violated international law or denied al-Awlaki his right to due process. On our website, we have a recent segment on the ethical issues raised by the use of drones. The United Nations Security Council has begun considering the Palestinian request for a UN-recognized independent state. It's expected to be weeks before the Council votes on the issue. Some Christian and Muslim organizations have urged the UN to recognize a Palestinian state. Other Christian and several Jewish groups continue to oppose the effort. After more than a year of delay and several calls from high-profile religious leaders, the Israeli government has reinstated a residency permit for the Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem. Because he's a Palestinian from the West Bank, Bishop Suhail Dawani needed the permit to remain in East Jerusalem, where the Anglican Cathedral is located. Dawani's request to renew his visa was originally denied amid questions about a land sale, although Israeli officials never lodged specific charges against Dawani. Recent executions in the United States have reignited the religious debate over the death penalty. This week, more than 250 Catholic scholars and theologians signed a petition to abolish capital punishment. The letter referred to earlier statements from the U.S. Catholic bishops and Pope John Paul II against the death penalty. This week, however, in a statement for their annual Respect Life Month, the bishops did not include any mention of capital punishment. Another enduring controversy involving Catholic teaching and civil law has been the definition of family. In the Church, it remains the married union of one man and one woman. However, many states have legalized same-sex marriages or at least civil unions. It's more than an academic discussion because church-based agencies are important providers of many publicly funded social services. Bob Farr reports from Chicago.
What number is this, Jeffrey?
Six.
Six. Good job.
Thousands of children in Illinois have been helped the last five decades by Catholic charities. Joliet, for example, the agency runs this Head Start program. It also shelters and nourishes children in need. Of 15,000 in the state's foster care program, the agency takes care of more than 2,000. Now, though, as Director Glenn Van Cura knows, Catholic charities is in a bitter legal dispute with the state, because when it comes to fostering or adopting children, the organization will take married and single people, but will not accept same-sex or unmarried couples.
To now pronounce you husband, and wife.
the idea between a man and a woman and marriage is a sacred bond. And cohabitating, gay or straight, that's not that sacred bond. It's not stable.
It's in violation of church doctrine, isn't
right.
it?
We will continue to say that children are best raised in the situation where there's a loving home and a mother and a father. And that will be true as long as we're able here to articulate it. It's the truth. And that's what the church is about, is trying to speak the truth to these very sometimes controversial social questions.
Last year, Illinois enacted a law recognizing same-sex unions. Now, couples like Michelle Mascaro and Corinne Romine have the right to foster or adopt children.
The church can decide whether or not they want to marry a couple. That's a church religious right. But the state has created ways for families to come together. And they've said, you know, that you can come together through adoption, and it doesn't matter what that family constellation looks like. Are you fit to be a parent?
Does it anger you? What's the... Because that clearly is...
It doesn't make me feel second rate because I'm not. It does make me angry, yes.
Okay. David, it's going to be your turn. Everybody, did you take...
Michelle and Corinne have adopted three children, David, Joseph, and Emma. Because Emma was adopted through a religious agency, the two women felt they had to hide their true relationship.
And they might say, no, you can't have this baby. Who was our baby? You know, she came right from the hospital home with us.
Catholic Charities says it's a matter of religious freedom, and that if civil law and church doctrine collide, doctrine takes precedence and gives it the right to discriminate. Bob Gilligan is with the Catholic Conference of Illinois, which is the public voice of the Catholic Church in the state.
When it comes to gay couples, then, they are excluded. Is that not discrimination?
There is a form of discrimination there, sure. We don't accept the application of an admittedly unmarried or same-sex couple.
Now, the state of Illinois is in the process of cutting off the nearly $4 million it funnels annually to Catholic Charities because it says discrimination against gay or unmarried couples who want foster children is illegal and short-sighted. Kendall Marlowe is with the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services.
I grew up in a family that took in foster children, and I've been a foster and an adoptive parent myself and as an adult. And if I've learned anything, it's that what helps a child succeed is that unconditional love and guidance. And in both my experience and in the research literature that has been produced on this issue, there's no indication that sexuality, sexual orientation has anything to do with parenting.
Child advocate from the ACLU, Benjamin Wolf, insists Catholic Charities policy harms children.
We need everybody. It's hard enough to provide good homes for abused and neglected children without imposing additional discrimination on the pool of foster parents.
There's not one example that they can show us that a child has not been placed in a home.
They're not excluded. There's 47 other private child welfare agencies in this state. There's many other agencies that they can go to.
It's not okay to say to people like us, if we lived in a part of southern Illinois or in Peoria, to say, oh, you can go to some other agency because Catholic Charities has the lock on it. They're the only agency out there.
Despite the fervently held beliefs on each side, the legal situation is anything but clear cut. Catholic Charities, for example, argues that the Illinois law on religious freedom permits the agency to discriminate.
The title of the bill is the Illinois Religious Freedom Protection and Civil Unions Act. Where's the freedom? Where is the protection for religious entities? It's in the bill itself. There's a section in there that says that the bill should not infringe upon religious practice, religious ministry.
Every faith-based organization in the state of Illinois has the full capacity and the full right to pursue their religious freedom. The question is, what happens when you are paid with taxpayers' money, state money, to provide state services? And in those cases, we have to insist that those agencies comply with Illinois law.
Catholic Charities of Illinois has placed thousands of children in homes over the past 50 years. 80% of its foster care budget comes from the state. Even if it loses that money, says Bob Gilligan, Catholic Charities will continue with adoption and foster care.
It's part of our mission, it's part of our teachings, it's part of what we do as Catholics. But we have to do it in honoring our own tenets and our faith that call us to do this. If we can't do it in a faith-filled mission, then we can't do it. We're using public money. We'll do it on our own terms.
We don't want to see them leave this work. But if that is what's going to happen, this Illinois child welfare system that they helped build is more than capable of taking on this transition. There are other agencies bound by the exact same regulations that Catholic Charities is that are ready to step up and take on this work.
Gay adoptive parents like Michelle and Corinne think that history is on their side, that eventually Catholic Charities' policy of exclusion will go the way of earlier social practices, like the 1950s when black Americans were denied public accommodations.
It harkens back to just saying, you can't eat in this lunch counter, go eat at one down the street. We know that in every other aspect, that's not right. It's not legal. It's not sanctioned in this country. Why is it still allowed, or could it be allowed, in adoption? This is an abuse of what they perceive as their religious freedom.
There were agencies 30 years ago, 20 years ago, that didn't want to place children in homes of interracial couples. I mean, the world is changing.
So the issue in Illinois, now focused on gay couples, comes down to this. When anti-discrimination laws and church doctrine clash, which should prevail?
This is an emerging conflict in our society. As you enact anti-discrimination laws, to what degree does a religious institution have to comply with it? We do a lot of things in the public square. Yeah. Is the Catholic Church in compliance with all the rules, policies, laws of the state if we won't do certain things against our conscience? It's a good question.
And as the definition of the modern family continues to change, will church doctrine also have to change? For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Chicago.
I recently visited a small town in western India to attend an unusual baby shower. There were gifts, and a Hindu priest conferred blessings on expectant mothers, a room full of expectant mothers. But even more unusual, none of them were carrying their own biological children. To the growing list of industries outsourcing to India, add surrogate mothering. Minutes after delivering a slightly premature infant by C-section, Dr. Naina Patel was back in her office and on the phone to the parents.
Congratulations, it's a baby girl. Where are you, in Mumbai right now?
They were en route from their home in England and didn't reach the small town of Anand, India, in time to watch a surrogate mother give birth to their child.
Surrogate is also fine. Yeah, and the baby is also fine. Huh? We have taken the picture.
Dr. Patel has delivered some 400 surrogate babies since 2004. Her clinic implants embryos in surrogates she recruits from the area and pays around $7,000 for a pregnancy carried to term. Biological parents come from across India and around the world. Krishna Rasvadan came here from Colorado to pick up her baby girl named Serenity. She was born 4 weeks premature, but after a week in neonatal intensive care, she was ready to be discharged. Serenity's 46-year-old mother traveled here with her 9-year-old son. She had tried unsuccessfully in recent years to conceive. Surrogacy was her last hope, and India her first choice. The cost, $10,000 to $15,000 all told, is a fraction of what it is in the United States. And in America, she added, surrogacy contracts are not always airtight.
You can sign 100 documents. It doesn't matter. If that surrogate changes her mind, she can sue you for that child. And oftentimes she will win. And coming here to India, these women, they don't want my child. It's very cut and dry. They do not want my child. They want my money. And that is just fine with me.
It's not fine with everyone.
And the contracts usually are written, to be blunt, to protect the wealthy people who are commissioning the baby, so that if the woman suffers an injury, if the woman has a health problem due to childbirth, if there's a long-term chronic condition, then what?
University of Pennsylvania ethicist Arthur Kaplan worries the relationship is inherently lopsided between poor, minimally literate women and well-heeled couples who commission them to have their children. For example, surrogates in India are routinely implanted with up to 5 embryos to improve the chances of a pregnancy. In the U.S., clinics usually implant no more than 2, sometimes 3.
Why would you use 3, 4, or 5 embryos in India? Because you don't want the couple to have to come back. It's expensive, even for a rich person. So you're trying to maximize the chance of pregnancy, even if it might compromise the interests of the babies.
Dr. Patel concedes that implanting 5 embryos heightens the risk for infants and mother, and says she's now lowering that number to 3 or 4. But she says the downside of fewer embryos is a lower pregnancy success rate. When multiple embryos develop into viable pregnancies, Dr. Patel performs a selective reduction. Aside from possible religious concerns, the procedure could present medical risks to the surviving fetuses.
Parents, yes, there are some who say right from the beginning that doctor put less embryos because we are not for reduction and we don't want this to happen. So in those cases, we definitely never transfer more than 2. But there are certain parents who do not have an objection to this, and surrogates, we don't allow them to carry more than 2.
Dr. Patel insists that her facility protects the interests of surrogates as much as the clients of her commercial surrogacy program and the infants she delivers.
We do a lot of psychological counseling to the surrogate and the family before we recruit them. We explain to them the procedure of IVF, what all they will have to undergo. If she has had any complications during her previous pregnancy, we will ask her not to become a surrogate because the same can repeat this time, to make it very sure and safe for her.
The moment their pregnancies are confirmed, surrogates are required to move into this home run by Dr. Patel. They're offered skills training in things like tailoring, but mostly it's a quiet, sedentary life.
The women who spend 9 months in the surrogate hostel have all experienced childbirth with their own biological children. It's a prerequisite for becoming a surrogate. What very few of them have experienced with those previous pregnancies is any kind of prenatal care. And that's in sharp contrast to the pampering they get here, with meals provided and medical attention should they need it round the clock.
Dr. Patel acknowledges the irony but says it's part of a thorough surveillance to ensure smooth pregnancies for both surrogate and parents' sakes.
We have a fetal medicine specialist who checks all the surrogates every 3 weeks. We have been able to detect minor congenital malformations, which we inform the couple that this can be treated post-delivery without any impact on the baby. We have had patients whose surrogate had babies with Down syndrome, which was detected, which was confirmed with amniocentesis, and we aborted those babies after the consent of the couple.
Well in advance, she says, parents are consulted on decisions like pregnancy termination. Similarly, parents must accept their babies once born, whether healthy or not. Surrogates we spoke to talked about building a new home and using their money for their children's education. The money, $7,000 to $8,000, would otherwise take them decades to earn. Most say they were happy to have helped infertile couples. The woman who bore baby Serenity, whom we met earlier, admitted to some sorrow at her separation.
You can't help it when you've carried a baby for 9 months. I'd like to see how she does in the future.
I do have her address, so I can get a hold of her. And I hopefully will be able to maintain some kind of a relationship with her.
We caught up with Serenity's mother in Mumbai, an hour's flight from Dr. Patel's clinic. She and son Brandon were holed up in a hotel, awaiting DNA test results and myriad documents to satisfy the Indian and U.S. governments that the infant could leave the country.
Am I living happily ever after now? I certainly hope so. I hope that I can get her home, and I hope that she is a happy, healthy little baby.
But will every surrogacy story end happily? Right now, India has only voluntary guidelines, and it's not clear whether future laws would be adequately enforced. And standards vary widely. For example, Dr. Patel says she only serves infertile patients, but some clinics offer surrogates to healthy parents who, for career or convenience, want to avoid pregnancy. Ethicist Kaplan worries about where all of this is leading.
We may get into situations where people start to say, as genetic knowledge improves, you know, I'm not infertile, but I'd like to make a baby with traits or properties that I want to avoid or that I desire. And that day is coming. And I think it's important to keep in mind as we watch the evolution of surrogacy as an international activity, what is really something that a tiny handful of people use who suffer from infertility, tomorrow can be what more people are interested in because they have a more eugenic or perfectionist interest in making their children.
For her part, Dr. Patel plans a major expansion of her one-stop surrogacy shop, a leader in what's now a $500 million industry in India. She makes no apologies for making a lucrative living and insists that she, the surrogates, and the new parents all come out winners.
In other news, Kenyan conservationist Wangari Maathai died this week of cancer at age 71. She was the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004 for her efforts to empower women to work for the environment and for social justice. On our calendar, Jews began their celebration of the High Holy Days, starting with Rosh Hashanah and ending with Yom Kippur. During this 10-day period of prayer and repentance, charity and good deeds, we have the story of an organization that's putting those ideas rooted in the Torah into practice. It was founded after federal agents raided the nation's largest kosher meat packaging plant in Postville, Iowa, and discovered widespread mistreatment of workers. The group, Yuri Ledzedek, which means awakened to justice, wants more transparency in the kosher industry, and they've started with restaurants.
What became clear to me in Postville was that we had to take responsibility, not a one-time act like a boycott, but something systemic and sustainable that would ensure that there was ethical transparency in the industry.
The Tav HaYosher, which we translate as an ethical seal for kosher restaurants, is an initiative that we launched in May 2009. We don't charge anything for this seal. We have a licensing agreement which they sign. The criteria for our certification is, first and foremost, we want to make sure that people get at least minimum wage. And we want to make sure that overtime based on that minimum wage is given. And then we also want to make sure that people are respected and work is dignified.
When we started the Tav HaYosher, we said, let's strive for the ideals. We want health care. We want animal treatment. We want environmental standards. We want fair trade. We want workers' comp, all these issues. And we went into restaurants finding workers getting paid $2 an hour, $3 an hour. Ridiculous. So we said, we have to first just meet law.
One of the really exciting things about this program is that it's a grassroots program. The people who actually go into the restaurants are volunteers, college students, graduate students, young professionals who care deeply about this mission and about this project. Every 2 or 3 months or so, we have a training.
There is nothing easy about the work we're trying to engage in. We are sending young volunteers to ask owners to open their books, to speak with workers about very sensitive issues.
We take them aside so that we create a safe space away from management, and we ask them questions to verify what the payroll actually says.
And what kind of things do you do here?
I do the driving.
How many hours have you worked? What is your pay? What's it like to work here? Do you feel ever harassed? The feedback we receive from restaurant workers, we keep it anonymous. And we also have an anonymous tip line.
We've approached locations that initially didn't meet standards. We spoke with them, encouraged them, and were able to come back and actually sign them on.
Sitting in a dark basement with a worker who paints black and white cookies, black, white, all day, every day, and seeing his eyes tear up when for the first time there was a customer concerned for his welfare, that rocked me spiritually, emotionally, to feel the impact of merely showing somebody else that we're present for them, we're an advocate for them.
We see this very much as a partnership between workers, the community, and restaurant owners.
I think I just felt as a good person, someone who believes in doing the right thing. I think it's important to set the standard. We've actually gotten numerous phone calls and numerous comments from customers who come in and let us know that they are supporting us because of the fact that we have the seal.
This is a new wave of activism, an activism through what one eats, that what we eat and what we buy is a vote of confidence in our highest values.
Tavha Yosher has certified over 90 eating establishments in 13 states and Canada. That's our program for now. I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, find us on YouTube, and watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones and iPhones. There's also much more on our website, including more about the Jewish High Holy Days. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the blessing of the animals at Washington's National Cathedral, held each year on the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, October 4th.
I'm sure you're taking good care of your owners. God bless you.
Thank you.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founder's interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.